Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCPR
106.5
FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
You are back in the House of Mystery, and of course I'm Al Warren, and if I could speak right, you'd know that. And Mr. Martino's in the back. You haven't blown up anything today, have you?
Not today. I'm working on it, though.
Has your wife locked you down? Are you yes. You're in quarantine in the quarantine?
Yes, double quarantine.
Double quarantine. Yeah, just put you in the basement. No, not even a cat.
No.
God, no. You know, almost blew up the house yesterday.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, you know. It's close.
I guess. Oh, you see, I was thinking about this last night. I was thinking it was probably your plan at so that you didn't have to cook dinner.
Yes.
Right? So then, Jesus, right. Not only are you just not that good of a cook, but you're going to blow up the place with your pressure cooker, and she's going to have to get dinner anyway, plus clean up the mess.
That's right. We have to get McDonald's or something.
Yeah. So now you probably got her just picking up stuff on the way home from her work.
That's right.
Yeah.
You know my whole plan now.
I see it now. Boy, could write a book. Speaking of writing a book, now this is, we've got a man today that has written a ton of books. Almost as much as the lady yesterday.
Yeah.
Almost. But it's crazy. It says more than 80 books. So it looks like it covers a lot of territory. So let's bring him in and talk about this. Welcome to the show, Mr. Caleb Pirtle III.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
Well, hopefully we'll say that at the end. You never know. So Caleb, you've written a lot of books. Where did writing start for you then?
Well, Alan, as soon as I realized I wasn't smart enough to dig ditches for a living, I decided to become a writer. Basically, that's all I ever wanted to do. I went to college at the University of Texas and majored in journalism, jumped into newspaper business, small newspapers, large newspapers, wound up with magazines, and eventually I worked for a publishing company for 25 years. And in the last 10 years, I have quit writing nonfiction, and basically now I write fiction.
Well, that's an interesting jump. I guess, so first of all, you never really had a fear of writing then, if you jumped right in the papers and were just going at her. You never had a fear of not being, you know, of writing incorrectly or having people chastise you if you didn't do a good article?
Well, you know, the only way that you can improve in my business is to make mistakes and have some editor throw a story back in your face and say, if you can't do better than this, you need to find another job. You start working real hard to do better than this. And, you know, as I started out in small town newspapers, the editors really didn't care what you wrote as long as you could fill up space between the advertising. When you got to bigger newspapers, they took it real serious. And in my whole life, I've always taken it really, really serious because I've read, if I'm not writing, I'm reading. And every time I read something new, I think there's an idea I've never tried before. Let me see if it'll work in my next book. Sometimes it does. Sometimes I don't have the touch that that author had, but you never know until you try.
Well, do you feel your work as a journalist, deadlines and such, do you feel that's made you a more efficient writer of fiction?
I think it did because it made me more of a regimented writer. Because in the newspaper business, especially when I worked for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, which at that time was the largest daily in Texas, we had four deadlines a day. You didn't miss a deadline. Our final deadline was 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and a lot of times I was out on a traffic fatality or a homicide, and I was digging up notes, and at 2 o'clock I was on the telephone dictating my story off the top of the head. And after you do that for a while, you learn what deadlines are all about. And so then you start putting your own deadline on yourself. And then when you write, like as I do now, and you're your own boss, you're writing for the toughest boss you've ever worked for in your life. There are no excuses, no sickness. When a book is due, that final page better be coming out of the machine.
Do you find yourself a very structured writer then? Like, can you sit down and plan this? Can you kind of go, well, you know, I've got from 11 to 5 today, there's nobody home, I'm by myself, so I can just sit down and write. And are you able to do that just on the whim, or do you have to be in a certain mood?
No, you're never in a certain mood. Like I said, I'm very regimented. I get up at 5 o'clock in the morning. We have a website that we work to promote other authors' books around the country. So I'm up at 5 o'clock. I load the website. Then I promote all the books on the website that day, as well as my own books on all the social media. Then I take a break. And at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I sit down and write. Every day at 2 o'clock, I sit down and write. There's no and, buts about it. You have a time. The first words start coming out of your word machine. And I found that the great way to do it, as I write 3 hours, at the end of the day, I write my last sentence, but I leave an incomplete sentence. So the next day when I sit down, I complete that sentence. And by the time I complete that sentence, I'm back into the story, and I can keep writing.
Oh, that's interesting. That's interesting. I haven't heard that one before. That's a good idea, you know. What made you go from, let's say, you were doing all nonfiction, and now you've gone into fiction? Was there a particular reason that you did that, or is it just, you know, that you got tired of nonfiction?
Well, because of the jobs that I had, I handled publicity for the state of Texas for their travel department. I became the first travel editor at Southern Living Magazine and was there for 10 years. So I wrote a lot of travel books. And then when I went to the publishing company, we did a lot of historical books. And, you know, after doing that for a while, you start to get the itch. I wonder if I could take what I've learned and turn it into fiction. And when I retired, I said, this is a perfect opportunity. Now I don't have their deadlines. I have my deadlines. I'm not writing their books. I can write my own books. I love thrillers. I love history. I love mysteries. So I sat down and started writing historical thrillers and historical mysteries. I may live in the present, but I prefer the past. It's just a lot more glamorous.
Yeah, it's certainly got a lot more personality, I think. Did you take actual historical situations, like real life situations or things that are really happening, and then put your story in that itself?
Well, you know, I'm a firm believer that fiction is packed with reality. It's packed with truths. There is much nonfiction in fiction as there is just pure fiction. Because as you go through life, you build up all of these experiences and all these things you've seen and been a part of and experienced them, and you lock them away in that strange little computer we call a brain. And every once in a while, you get to the point in a story, and all of a sudden, something that happened to you 25 years ago just jumps out on the page. And it's there before you realize it, and you read it and think, the good Lord, that you had that experience, because it works just the way on fiction that it did in nonfiction.
Well, yeah, I find one difference now. So when you write nonfiction, again, like you said, it's their story. So the characters, you're really, you're not creating them. You're sort of explaining them. You're learning about them, and you're learning about what they did, and you're telling a story on what or how they did. You know, it's true crime, or if it's just a biography, or whatever you're doing, right? So you don't really create that. But in fiction now, you're creating the characters you're using. And I guess you would take some of that from yourself and maybe from others around you. I'm not sure. So maybe explain your process on developing and creating characters.
Well, what I always do, and before I put the first word on a piece of paper, I really get to know my character. I know everything there is to know about that character. That character comes to life. I know what he likes for breakfast. I know what he likes to drive. I know where he likes to go and when he likes to go. And until he just becomes a living, breathing character. And some characters suddenly exist total and you don't even expect it. For example, a few years ago, I was roaming the channels at night. I always roam between the History Channel, the Discovery Channel, National Geographic. You never know what wonderful documentaries you're going to run across. And I ran across a documentary in the 1930s. The United States government was conducting a lot of behavioral experiments trying to reprogram and remap a human's brain, really using hallucinatory drugs, electrical shock treatments. They wanted to be able to erase that person's mind so they could put their thoughts in his mind and he could do things that he couldn't do otherwise. They would erase his mind. They would erase his memories. And I didn't know this actually happened. They took volunteers. They took people from the army. They took people from prisons. They took people from insane asylums. And I'm sitting there totally enthralled. And I heard this voice beside me just as clearly as I hear your voice. And he said, that happened to me. And I asked, why did it happen to you? And he said, they believed if they could erase my mind, they could erase my fears. And a man who is not afraid to die is not afraid to do anything he's supposed to do, even if it's an impossible thing to do. And that character just came to life that night. And I've written a four-book series now based upon the exploits back in the late 1930s, just prior to World War II, on Ambrose Lincoln. So I have four historical thrillers based on his character, the man who lost his mind.
So you can actually hear your characters. You have an inner monologue when you're writing these.
Yeah, you know, and I speak at a lot of writers' conferences, and I mention that, And if you're not a writer, you think I'm crazy. And you're probably right. But if you are a writer, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yep.
Our characters, they talk to us. In fact, when I'm sitting down writing a scene, I'm not making it up. I'm following my characters, and I'm watching what they do, and I'm listening to what they say, and then I put it on paper. In fact, I had a writer here a while back write and said, you know, for the first time in my life, I'm in the middle of a book, and I've got a writer's block, and I can't make it go. I've worked for weeks, and it won't go any further. And I said, probably what you're trying to do is you have a story, and you're trying to force your characters to go there, and your characters don't want to go there because your characters have a better story.
Right.
I said, just relax, sit down, and follow your characters. A week later, I got an email back that said, you're right, I'm off and running. Don't ever try to force your characters to do something they don't want to do.
That's good advice.
So how do you describe your relationship with your characters then? And I ask that because a lot of the nonfiction writers we talk to, or fiction writers, I should say, quite often will tell me they're like their families, they're like their children. I hear all these different terms used when people are trying to explain their characters. What's your relationship?
Well, you know, you get real close to your characters. And if you'll notice, the real reason that most authors write a series of books, for example, I've got my Ambrose Lincoln series, I've got my Roland Sand series, I've got my Eudora Durant series. And the reason you write series is that you like your characters so well, you don't want to say goodbye. So instead of putting a period, closing the machine, closing the book and saying, that's it. About a week later, you think, well, I wonder what old Ambrose is up to now. And you sit down and start the next book in the series.
Hmm. So when you go through each character and you're going through a series and you're writing a book, and you say you see some of the events, like you're seeing the actual event happening that you're writing, uh-huh. Scene, do you actually play it out completely? Do you actually do that even live with your own physical body?
No, I would never do that. Like I say, I sit there and watch what they do. And as they do it, I'm writing it down. As they're talking, I'm writing dialogue. It's almost like you've got this little bitty television set sitting right in front of your eyes. And you're watching all the scenes, the action. You're hearing all the dialogue as it comes together. Now, once it's all on paper, you will certainly go back and start rearranging and rewriting threads of dialogue that don't work nearly as well as you thought they did, or expanding on the dialogue and expanding on the scene. But and it's just not your primary characters that you get involved with. In fact, in one of the Ambrose Lincoln books, I had a character that I just needed for one scene. He didn't even have a name. But it was that scene where Ambrose is trying to escape. He's running up these stairs in a walk-up hotel. He runs into a room, and there's this little man sitting there, and it's his room, and he doesn't know what's happening, and he's scared to death. And as they're talking, the door bursts open, this bad guy comes in, and Ambrose kills him. I'm thinking, okay, I needed that character. It's kind of like a day character in a movie script. You bring him in, you do the scene, you pay him off, you leave him, you never listen to him or hear from him again. George never left. The next thing I knew, he was in another scene. He was in so many scenes, I had to go ahead and give him a name, George Giddings. And little did I know at the time, but in the very climactic scene when the critical gunfight happened and Lincoln is laying there wounded and no way to reach his gun, it's little George Giddings that fires the fatal shot to save the day.
Wow.
I had no idea George was going to play that kind of role. So you just write him in, and if he doesn't leave, you know there's something important somewhere down the line. So you just let him go and see what happens.
When you're watching the story in your mind, do you feel like it's like a dream or a daydream? I know sometimes when I write, I find that things kind of change. Like, it'll be day, and then it'll just be night all of a sudden. Do you have continuity problems like that that have to be fixed later? Or are you able to kind of stay in the moment as you're writing the story?
You know, I'm pretty much able to stay with what I'm doing until I get through and the rewrite starts. It's kind of like all good writers really take after James Michener. James Michener said, "I'm not a very good writer, but I'm a real good rewriter." Hmm. And that's where you really come in and add the final touches and the flourishes and the impact statements and the impact scenes that really make a book work.
You know, when someone writes nonfiction, or if you're writing in an article or paper, a lot of times there's a meaning besides the event that happened. Like if you're covering a murder or something, there's maybe a point to it. So when you're writing fiction, do you do the same? And I mean that, is there underneath the story itself, the drama or whatever the story's about, is there some sort of subtext or some sort of meaning or something that you hope people get out of that?
Yeah, there's always an underlying current that works its way through a story. And more likely, it works its way through the character and the roles and the parts he has to play. Because in all good fiction, even a character that's on his fourth book, he's got to keep changing. You don't want the same old character. He's got certain personalities and certain complexities that stays true. But all of a sudden, you may seem really warm-hearted when you thought he had a heart made of ice. So there's always the way to change your characters. And by changing your characters, you change that underlying story. And so often, the story that's on paper is really not the story that you want to tell, especially if your book has something to do with social issues. And all good fiction has something to do with social issues, or at least those issues at the time that people may not have realized played such a major role in their lives. But looking back, they realize they did.
Does that sort of put you more on guard these days? Do you feel like you have to be a little bit more concerned about how you word things or how you present them in such a sensitive generation now?
You know, probably that's a good reason to write historical fiction, because you don't have to worry so much about that, because those things that people are sensitive about now, they were also sensitive about in the 1930s or the 1870s. They just expressed it in an entirely different way. And sometimes learning how social issues were met and evolved and solved in 1897 really kind of gives you a key to how you need to act in 2022.
So when you write these series of books, do you sort of have this outlined? Like you say, you're pretty structured. So do you know how it's going to end, so to speak, maybe at the end of each book or even the end of the series, and you're writing your way to that point, or is it more as it happens?
Well, when I first started, Alan, I would write my first paragraph of a book and my last paragraph at the same time, working under the philosophy that maybe this is like a roadmap. If you know where you're leaving and you know where you're going to, then you can find a way to get there. But invariably, by the time I got to the ending, It was so different. I had to rewrite the ending, which meant I had to go back and rewrite the beginning. So now I just sit down. I'm sure you've heard the phrase many times. I'm more of a pantser. I just write by the seat of the pants. I write the first sentence in a book and see where it takes me. And I know the book that here a while back I wrote, it's a historical fiction, but set back during the Great Depression. It was called Bad Side of a Wicked Moon. And all of a sudden I came in to my wife, and I was all excited. She could see that I was excited. And she said, what's the matter? I said, I've just reached page 256, and I know who the bad guy is. Up till that time, we had a thread of crime working its way through the book, but I had no idea who the killer was. And on page 256, I finally figured it out. Usually, I figure it out when my main character tells me.
Do you ever take people that you don't like and use them in your books and make them the bad guy or have them killed?
Always. And sometimes I even use their real names.
Oh.
But if you read my books, if you find somebody that's really killed and in a strange and heinous manner, you might want to think back, is that me? Because it very well could be.
Well, we didn't know each other.
It's the way you can give back to people and still remain friends.
Wow, that's great. That's I'll remember that. Newest series looks like you just put out is the Boomtown Saga 3-book series.
Boomtown Saga.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about that story. Like, what is this?
Well, the Boomtown Saga is back during the early days of the Great Depression. It's written about a fictional East Texas town that was dying on the vine. Businesses were going out of business. People were leaving. There was a drought. The stores were all shuttering their windows and closing their door, and people were just dying on the vine. And into town comes a con man with a doodle bug machine. And he, by hook or crook or good fortune, finds oil. And all of a sudden, this little town is drawn back to life because oil has broken the back on the Great Depression. But with oil, there becomes money. And with money, there's greed. And with greed... There's murder. So you fictionalize it. But it's basically I'm writing about what I know best. I was born and raised in Kilgore in East Texas, which in 1931, a con man came into town. He sold shares for $25. He raised money, and he actually drilled an oil well. And then to raise money.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
To drill that first oil well, he would go to Dallas and pick up a copy of the Dallas Morning News and read the obituary columns. And in the obituary columns, he would find the richest new widows, and he would go pay his respects to the widows. And he was quoted as saying, and this is in a newspaper article, "Every woman has a certain place on her neck that when I kiss it, she starts writing checks." So he financed the Kilgore boom with the checks from the widows in Dallas and from those little shares that he sold. And all of a sudden, Kilgore became one of the biggest boom towns in America. East Texas oil field was the largest oil field ever discovered. And so as I grew up in the midst of this, on the cusp of this great oil boom, I grew up listening to stories about the people, the places, the things, the crooks, the criminals. They even had to send in the Texas Rangers to get things under control because it became such a wicked and unruly boom town. But I had all these stories that had been tucked away in my brain for 30 or 40 years, and all of a sudden I thought, you know, I've got the best background of any story that I've ever had. The time has probably come to tell it. There's been enough funerals. So that's when I became my Boomtowns, or when I started writing my Boomtown series.
It must take quite a bit of, like you say, you know it, but it must take quite a bit of research to kind of make sure details are correct. Like if you're writing in a time period like the 30s in a certain area, you have to make sure that the slang of the time is right, the way people used their words, the way they dressed, the way they behaved, their habits, the customs, as well as what's going on. Like when you talk about, you know, just the area and the town. So that how long does that take you to research something like this out?
It takes quite a bit of time because I do as much or more research on fiction as I do on nonfiction, because you're exactly right. If you make a mistake writing nonfiction and somebody realizes it, you've suddenly lost all credibility. So you have to make sure the clothes are right, the weapons are right. And the first draft of my first Ambrose Lincoln book, set in 1939, I sent it to my editor, and the editor emailed back and said, "You better check his weapon. You've got him carrying a Glock," and they didn't invent the Glock till 1952. So I immediately went back and said, "Okay, what kind of weapons did the military use in the 1920s? So you really have to be accurate. And in that Ambrose Lincoln series, one of the books, that was the Night of Broken Glass, I had the train coming into Poway, Poland, to pick up the Jews to carry to the death camps. Now, I researched and researched until I found the actual name of the company who built the trains that actually went to Poway, Poland, and picked up the Jews for the death camps, and I used it in the book. Now, nobody else will ever realize that that's probably the truth, but I know. And as long as I know, I can feel good about it.
Well, yeah, you never know. There's always that one person.
There's always one who's flying out there that's just looking for mistakes.
Yeah.
And God bless them. We need to find out where the mistakes are and change them.
Yeah, yeah. But there's always, I always find there's one or two out there that all of a sudden will email you and tell you something that you didn't know. But I think it's really important. It's super important. How long does it take you then to put together? Like this new series of three books that you just released, how long did that take to actually get out?
I've spent probably, once I start, I will get a book out in 3 months. Right now, I'm trying to get at least two books and mostly three books out a year. In fact, as I said, I talk to a lot of writers groups, and a lot of people want to be writers and they want to write books. But the thought of putting together a 300-page book is kind of a daunting experience that lays in front of them. They're almost afraid to start. And then I tell them the formula is real simple. Just write 3 pages a day. Even if you're on a roll, stop at the end of 3 pages and write 3 pages every day during the week. Take Saturday and Sunday off, but write just 3 pages a day. It only takes 45 minutes or an hour to write 3 good pages a day. And at the end of 6 months, you'll have a book. Now, 6 months is going to come. You can either have a book or not have a book, but 6 months will be here. So you might as well have one ready for a publisher.
What do you think of today's publishing world with, you know, now the big guy Amazon out there and a lot of people just self-publish and it's just there's just like a million titles a day coming out. So, but what do you think in general of the way people are publishing now?
Well, when the digital revolution hit, nobody knew what to do with it. And that includes the big five publishers in New York. They're almost afraid to do anything beyond what they're doing. It is the reason they're primarily just sticking to their authors that they know sell well. And when their authors die, they still put the names on the front and hire other people to write the stories. But the big problem that the digital revolution caused is, as you said, anybody can throw out a book. And there's, for every good book that's in the marketplace, for every book written by an author who really works hard to hone his craft and develop the best story he can possibly develop, you'll have 100 pieces of schlock that's thrown out there. So, but it almost, the ship almost writes itself, because people who write schlock all of a sudden realizes their book's hidden selling on Amazon, and so they don't write anymore. And you know, it's one of those, a whole new industrial revolution as far as the book world is concerned. And, you know, you just keep sticking with it. And as a result, there are a lot of real good small publishers that really care about authors and really care about stories and really care about books that are legitimate traditional authors. They aren't as big as the boys in New York, but you can still find real good, solid small publishers to work with. And they will make sure that you don't stop until you have a book worth publishing and, more important, a book worth reading.
Well, what do you think the biggest mistake some of the writers are making then? I think they're just not getting themselves edited. They're not. Where's the biggest problem?
The biggest problem is their books look homemade and their books read homemade. They've never really studied how a book is put together. They may have read a lot of romances, so they think, I can write a romance. You get a man and a woman, and you work the formula, and all of a sudden you have a book, and they don't realize all the little nuances that take place within a book that make it happen. For example, one of the great books out there on whether you're writing film scripts or whether you're writing books is called Save the Cat, written by a screenwriter who really narrows it down. This is in the first 15 pages, this has to happen. In the next 30 pages, this has to happen. On page 50, you introduce your subplot, and he leads you right through it to the point that 15 pages before the end, and I'm talking about a script, it'd be about 45 pages before the end in a novel, all is lost. You read it and you think there's not any hope, regardless of what the genre is. In historical fiction, they're not going to be able to cross the raging river. And a romance, the hero has run off and she'll never be able to find him. And a thriller, the bad guy has the good guy and a cell and chains, and he's locked away and can't get out. Everything, all is lost. And it's those last 45 to 50 pages of a novel that make it all worthwhile. In fact, Linda and I can go to a movie or watch a movie on television, and all of a sudden she'll look at me and say, well, we're 15 minutes from the end because all is lost. So after a while, you just have to learn how the formula of a good, solid story is put together and follow that story and believe in that formula because it works every time.
Well, speaking of scripts, I'm just curious, you've written for you've written screenplays, and I was just wondering how you got into writing for movies and television.
Well, I had a real good friend who was in the film business, Frank Q. Dobbs. He and I had done a lot of industrial scripts together for clients he had with his Houston film company, and he always wanted to write and be a part of feature films. So he went to Los Angeles and started writing, and he had really cut his teeth on the old Gunsmoke series, writing scripts for it. So he became the resident Western authority in Hollywood. And for example, he read that CBS was wanting to do 7 Westerns. So he called me and said, you know, why don't we do a Western? And we had a story about finding oil. And I said, what I'll do is just change that script to where we're no longer looking for oil, but we're in a Western looking for water. The story is the same. The drama is the same. It'll work. So he went to CBS, and CBS said, well, we've already sold those Westerns. What now? We're looking for a historical period piece. And Frank reached in his briefcase and pulled out our oil script and said, have we got a deal for you? So that's how we got the first one done. And then he got involved with Larry Levinson, who was doing all the Gambler series. And we did the two-part miniseries on Gambler 5 with Kenny Rogers, Lonnie Anderson, and Dixie Carter for CBS. And so we did that miniseries. Film scripts are wonderful to write. There's a lot of money to be made on good film scripts, but you have to go out to California and play the game. And I've never been willing to go to Los Angeles. So
terrible, I guess I'll place.
Pass me by.
It's a terrible place. I'm the first one to tell you that. It really, really is.
I thought you might have a first name basis with L.A.
Yeah, I do, and it's not a good name. Do you ever look back at some of your earliest books and think that you'd like to rewrite them? Or, you know, it's quite often writers will say that they – they dislike some of the earliest books, or they're not good, or the way they rewrote them, or they could write them differently and stuff. I think that's probably something that's common amongst writers. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, it's always common, but it's also kind of interesting to go back and look at the first book that I ever did and the last book that I ever did, because the first books, I mean, I was overflowing with purple prose. I was trying to turn narrative into poetry. I wanted people to be able to see the color of the blossoms in the trees and smell the lilac bushes. And then as I've gone along, my writing has become a lot more spare, a lot more sparse. In those days, I was trying to set a beautiful scene. Today, I'm trying to see what the characters do within that scene. And it's almost something I learned when I was writing film scripts. Well, when I wrote the first one, I would set the scene in this Western town, and I would tell everybody in the script where everything was. I would describe the saloon, describe the bank, describe the street scene, describe the corral, describe the mountains in the distance and the melting snow coming down in the crevasse and then the arroyos. And the producer said, "Pertle, just write, cut the street scene. The director will figure out how to set it." So now when I go into a town, I explain the town to where you really understand the mood and the thoughts and the personality of the town, but I don't spend all that time on descriptions. Because, one of the great writers once said, "It's all right to describe the bedroom, but don't furnish it." And so now I may write the about the town, but I don't furnish it.
Hmm. If you were to look back then at all of your books, and someone has never read one of your books before, which one would you choose for them to read that would get a good flavor of who you are as a writer?
I think probably now I would ask them to read the first book in the Boomtown series, because it's probably my Ambrose Lincoln books may be a little too spare. My Roland Sand books series may be too introspective. And I think with my Boomtown series, I have been able to work my way through and be able to have introspective and a lot of internal dialogue and dialogue that really work well in those books that probably I would like to go back and change some of the scenes and Ambrose Lincoln and Roland Sand. But I'm writing new Roland Sand books and new Lincoln books, so I'll have an opportunity in the new books to try to make that transition. But because probably the most important thing in writing a novel these days is internal dialogue. In fact, I've often said, you hear people go to a movie and then you hear them read the book, and they always say the book is better than the movie. And the reason is, in the book, you can tell what the point of view character is thinking. And in a movie, all you see is his reaction, his facial reactions. You never know what he's thinking.
Now, you mentioned your wife, and I see that she's also a writer. What's it like having two writers in the house, and do you act as each other's first readers?
Well, Linda was in education until she retired. Hmm. She was a high school English teacher, then a high school principal, and spent her whole life in education. Hmm. And after she retired, she didn't have anything to do, and wondered why I went into my office, closed the door, and had the best time of my life all alone, surrounded by characters she couldn't see or hear. So I dared her to write a book. And she's the type of person, don't dare her to do something, she will do it. And she always loved cozy mysteries. So Linda wrote her first cozy mystery, The Mahjong Murders, and it really sold like hotcakes. And so now she's written four cozy mysteries and is working on her fifth book. So she's really gotten into the writing. Now, the difference is I write every day. It's just part of breathing. If I didn't sit down and write, I'm not sure what I would do. She writes on Wednesdays. She finds that one day a week, and that's her writing day. It's Wednesday.
Well, don't get in her way on Wednesday.
Yep. Don't even speak to her on Wednesday. In fact, it's almost gotten to the point that we live together and email each other. And if it's important, she'll call me on the phone. But very seldom do our paths cross within the house.
Oh, it's better that way.
it's a lot better. The other thing is, now, and when we do sit down at the dinner table, we have something to talk about. She can tell me what her characters are going to do, and I can tell her about what my characters are doing, and she can tell me what they're doing wrong. And most times, she's right.
She's right even when she's wrong. Come on.
Mm-hmm. You got that. But really, she really has good points. And well, as an old English teacher, she doesn't tell you what's wrong. She makes you think until you figure out how you did it wrong and how she'd go back and redo it and make sure it's right.
Bet you she has a big ruler.
A big ruler. And then I've got busted knuckles.
Yeah, it's like that. I had that, you know. My teacher back in the 60s would slap, because I wrote with my left hand. That was a big no-no back then. And so she would always hit me with the ruler.
Yeah. And it was acceptable. And you knew it was going to happen.
Yeah.
And you just lived with it.
Exactly. Because that's what you had to do. What other choice was there?
Well, for me, the person who probably had the biggest influence on my life was my high school English teacher. She was the hardest English teacher that the good Lord ever put on this earth. When you wrote themes, if you had a comma blunder, a comma fault, a comma error, it was an automatic F from that point, and she never read the rest of the theme. She called me in one day, and she said, all right, I'm reading your themes. Because I was trying to be a writer. I would write the one-word paragraph, the incomplete sentence, the impact sentence. And she said, okay, I know what you're trying to do. You want to be a writer. She said, you're not a very good writer, but I'll tell you what, I'll make a deal with you. On your themes, you write it the way you want to write it. And if you'll put a little asterisk up that says, this is wrong, I know it's wrong, but I did it anyway, she said, I won't count off. And she was the first one that really gave me the freedom to try to be a writer. And I'm always indebted to her.
Boy, she'd probably have a stroke if she read social media.
Thank God she's no longer with us, or she wouldn't be with us all.
Yeah, she wouldn't. They wouldn't like that, I'll tell you. So how do you like to interact with people? Do you have a website? Do you do social media? What's your favorite interaction with readers?
You know, the wonderful thing is on the website, you have the comments, and you have long strings and long threads of comments about your books and other books. And in the back of all my books, I put my email address and say, hey, if you like this book, I'd like to know about it. If you don't like this book, I'd love to know about it, because what your thoughts are really help me improve my writing in the future. And a lot of people will just write because they've never had an opportunity to talk with a used word salesman before. And so you get to go and learn from readers, which is one reason Lynn and I speak at so many writers' conferences, is you not only have writers, you have would-be writers, and you have readers, and this gives you an opportunity to sit around when nobody's on stage and drink coffee together and spill ideas together and find out what the reader thinks. You know, what does the reader want? And am I able to deliver what the reader wants? Because you're really torn these days between writing what you want to write, the stories you want to write, and the stories that the reader wants to read. And probably the biggest mistake I'm making right now is so many of my books being thrillers and really mysteries. Most books are read by women, and so much of what I write would probably be enjoyed more by men readers than women readers, which is why in the Boomtown series, my lead character is Eudora Durant, and she's one of these 1930s abusive wives that woke up one day and she's not going to take it anymore, and she's on a one-woman crusade, and she fights back every opportunity she has to fight back, and she has really struck a tone with a lot of women readers out there that says, yeah, that's the kind of character we like to know existed in 1931.
Wow. Sounds like you met Dave's wife. No. Boy, I'm in trouble for that one.
And it was kind of interesting because my original concept was to write Backside of a Blue Moon from the con man's point of view, because from my days working on the police beat for the Star-Telegram, I always loved good con artists if they were really good con artists. And so this was going to be a book about a flim-flam man. And he was in the first chapter. Second chapter, I wrote about Eudora Durant. And by the time I finished her chapter, I said, nope, this is Eudora's story. And I put her on chapter one and the con man on chapter two. And Eudora has run off with the series. It's all about her now. And she works well.
Wow.
She's probably modeled after my wife.
To get that in. Well, it's certainly been a pleasure. You know, our time is run out, and we really appreciate. So our guest today is the writer, Caleb Pirtle III. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for allowing me. It's been my pleasure.
Thanks, Caleb.
Tired of wasting time trying to decide what to watch on your streaming service? Go to our website and look for the Martino Movie Reviews.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has two limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code MOM.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.